Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Removal Jurisdiction Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 7, 2014, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Dart Cherokee Basin Operating Company v. Owens. The question in this case was whether a defendant seeking removal to federal court is required to include evidence supporting federal jurisdiction in the notice of removal, or whether it is enough to allege the required short and plain statement of the grounds for removal. To discuss the case, we have Tyler Green, who is Associate Chief Counsel at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Litigation Center. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Green.
My name is Tyler Green. I'm the Associate Chief Counsel for Litigation at the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center in Washington, D.C. And today I'll discuss the U.S. Supreme Court case of Dart Cherokee Basin Operating Company versus Owens. This case was argued at the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday, October 7th, 2014. And by way of disclosure at the outset, I should note that the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center filed amicus briefs in support of the petitioners at both the certiorari stage and on the merits. Now, Dart Cherokee presents what we think is an interesting and important procedural question that affects a defendant's ability to have its case heard in a federal forum. In short, that question is, when a defendant removes a case from state court to federal court, does the defendant have to include with its notice of removal evidence that establishes the amount and controversy in the case? Or may it merely allege in the removal notice that the amount in controversy is met and introduce evidence establishing that amount later in the proceedings if the plaintiffs dispute that issue? So today I'll begin by reviewing the factual and procedural background in this case, and then I'll describe the party's legal arguments, and we'll end by offering some thoughts about what the Supreme Court might do. So first, here are the basic facts. Brandon Owens, who is the respondent in the Supreme Court, sued Dart Cherokee Basin Operating Company and Cherokee Basin Pipeline in Kansas State Court. He sought royalty payments under certain oil and gas leases, and he styled his lawsuit as a class action on behalf of about 400 other similarly situated plaintiffs. And it's important to note here that Mr. Owens did not specify in his complaint the amount of damages he sought for himself or for the class. Upon seeing the allegations in the complaint, the defendants decided to remove this case from Kansas State Court to a federal district court in Kansas. They invoked the federal court's jurisdiction under the Class Action Fairness Act, a statute that's sometimes referred to by its acronym of CAFA. And as you may know, CAFA expands federal jurisdiction by allowing defendants to remove to federal court any state court class action that meets certain threshold requirements. Most relevant here are the requirements the proposed class contain at least 100 members, and that there be at least $5 million in controversy. Now, it was clear from the complaint's allegations here that there were at least 100 potential members of this class. That meant the only debatable threshold requirement was the amount in controversy. And to determine that number, the defendants looked at the number of potential plaintiffs, the number of royalty interests at issue in the case, and the period of time for which the plaintiffs sought damages. And based on those factors, they calculated the potential damages to be about $8.2 million, well above CAFA's $5 million threshold. The defendants alleged those facts in some detail in their notice of removal to federal district court. Now, despite those detailed allegations, Mr. Owens asked the federal court to remand the case back to state court. He did not dispute the facts the defendants had alleged to support jurisdiction, but instead he argued that the defendant's notice of removal was deficient under Tenth Circuit precedent because it did not contain evidence, such as an affidavit or a declaration, establishing that the amount in controversy was $8.2 million. The defendants responded by submitting a declaration showing, based on their additional research, that the amount in controversy in this case actually exceeded $20 million. But the district court agreed with Mr. Owens and remanded the case to state court because that evidence was not included with the initial removal papers. Now, CAFA not only expands federal court jurisdiction over class actions, but it also gives federal appellate courts discretion to review orders remanding CAFA cases to state court. This particular CAFA provision is an important exception to the usual rule that prohibits federal appellate courts from reviewing remand orders. Here, defendants ask the Tenth Circuit to exercise its discretion under CAFA to review whether the remand order was correct. A three-judge panel of the Tenth Circuit denied defendants' request to appeal. The defendants then asked the full Tenth Circuit to review the remand order. Because some of the judges on the Tenth Circuit recused themselves from this case, eight judges ended up reviewing the defendants' request to the full court. And among those eight, the final vote was an even 4-4 split. The four judges who would have reviewed the remand order were Judges Hartz, Kelly, Timkovich, and Phillips. Judge Hartz wrote a strong dissent from the decision not to review the case, which those other three judges joined. Among other things, Judge Hartz said that the district court's remand order, quote, imposes an evidentiary burden that is foreign to federal court practice, and to my knowledge, has never been imposed by a federal appellate court. Now, Judge Hartz surely intended this language to get the Supreme Court's attention, and it obviously worked because the Supreme Court granted the defendant cert petition seeking further review. So with those background facts in mind, let me turn next to the parties' legal arguments. The petitioner's main argument is that the federal removal statute, found at 28 United States Code, Section 1446A, requires a notice of removal to contain only, quote, a short and plain statement of the grounds for removal. The petitioners argue that this language imposes only a pleading burden, not an evidentiary one. And they claim that it intentionally mirrors the standard in Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which itself is universally acknowledged to be only a pleading standard. According to the petitioners, if the plaintiff or the court disputes the amount in controversy that defendants allege in a notice of removal, then the defendant must come forward with evidence to justify or support their allegations. But they contend that the removal statute imposes no such evidentiary burden until the allegations themselves are disputed. Mr. Owens, in contrast, focuses his argument on a separate section of the federal removal statute. He turns to 28 U.S.C. Section 1446C2, which states that removal of the action is proper on the basis of an amount in controversy if the district court finds, by the preponderance of the evidence, that the amount in controversy exceeds the amount specified in the federal diversity jurisdiction statutes. Mr. Owens contends that this textual requirement, the requirement that a court must find, quote, by a preponderance of the evidence, that the amount in controversy is met, supports the Tenth Circuit precedent requiring defendants to include evidence with their initial removal papers rather than waiting to submit such evidence after a later challenge. Now, if these dueling viewpoints were the only legal question at issue in the case, the way oral argument unfolded might have suggested a clear direction that the court would take. Specifically, Justice Kagan suggested to petitioner's counsel near the end of his argument that the respondent's argument during the next half hour would, quote, reveal that, actually, most of us agree with you on the merits. That's a quote from page 21 of the argument transcript. Now, to be sure, Justice Alito immediately suggested that Justice Kagan's suggestion might be a little premature, but the overall tenor of the argument did indeed suggest to tea leaf readers that a majority of the justices agreed with the petitioner's interpretation of the removal statute. But the way this case has unfolded, the proper interpretation of the removal statute is not the only legal question at issue. One amicus brief supporting respondent calls into question the Supreme Court's jurisdiction to opine on the proper interpretation of the removal statute. That amicus brief was filed by the Public Citizen Litigation Group, and it argues that the court's certiorari jurisdiction extends only to cases in the Court of Appeals, and that because the Tenth Circuit refused to review the district court's remand order on the merits, the only case that was ever in the Tenth Circuit was the discretionary determination about whether to grant review. Thus, according to Public Citizen, the only question properly before the Supreme Court in this case is whether the Court of Appeals abused its discretion when it denied leave to appeal. Now, this argument obviously captured the justices' attention. During oral argument, they peppered counsel for both sides with questions about the implications of Public Citizen's argument. Petitioner's counsel responded by noting the very broad scope of the court's certiorari jurisdiction, pointing out that once a case is in a court of appeals, the Supreme Court has the authority to review a district court's judgment even before the Court of Appeals enters its own separate judgment. Petitioner's counsel also relied on a prior Supreme Court case called Nixon v. Fitzgerald from 1972, in which the Supreme Court reviewed the merits of a district court's judgment even though the Court of Appeals had dismissed the case for lack of jurisdiction. It's effectively the same posture that exists in this case here. The respondent's counsel, for his part, seemed content to rely on the arguments in Public Citizen's brief to argue that the best the Supreme Court could do here would be to review whether the Tenth Circuit abused its discretion by refusing to review the remand order. So let me conclude with some thoughts about where the court might end up. Of course, predictions of this type are frequently worth what you pay for them, but with that in mind, I will venture a guess that if the court decides to reach the merits of the question presented, at least five justices will agree with petitioners and hold that the federal removal statute imposes a pleading burden only and not an evidentiary burden. In that case, the court would likely reverse Tenth Circuit's line of cases requiring a defendant to include in its notice of removal evidence that establishes the amount in controversy. But I think the bigger and closer question here is whether the court will reach the merits. And based on oral argument alone, I think the answer to this question could go either way. The justices posed equally hard questions to both sides, and it seemed that justices favoring each position left the bench undecided. Now, if the court does reach the merits, it may well be that the opinion will also contain a detailed and lengthy discussion and may even become a path-marking decision about the scope of the court's certiorari jurisdiction and its power to review discretionary decisions by the courts of appeals. But that, of course, is something that we'll have to shake out in the writing, and we'll all need to stay tuned to see what the court ultimately says.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.